Hello and welcome to Resources Radio, a weekly podcast from Resources for the Future. I'm your host, Daniel Ramey. Today, we talk with Travis Roach, Associate Professor of Economics and Director of the Central Policy Institute at the University of Central Oklahoma. Along with co-author Anne M. Burton, Travis recently published a working paper that quantifies how airborne particles increase fatal traffic accidents in the United States. This finding builds on a fast-growing stream of research that demonstrates how harmful fine particulates are, both in the short term and the long term, for human health and decision making. Travis will describe what his research finds, how it fits into this growing body of evidence, and what it all means for public policy, environmental justice, and more. Stay with us. All right, Travis Roach from the University of Central Oklahoma, welcome to Resources Radio.
Hey, thanks for letting me be here.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. I'm really excited to talk about this new working paper on particulate matter in traffic accidents. But before we get into the substance, we always ask our guests how they got interested in working on environmental issues, either as a kid or later in life. So what drew you into this line of work?
Oh, it's probably a lot of things. I should give credit to two fantastic public school teachers I had in high school, Penny Smelter and Bill Blaine, who taught me AP statistics and AP economics. They're truly just master teachers. And I didn't know it at the time, but they really set up what would be just like a crucial foundation for the rest of my life. But going on into college, so I went up to University of North Texas. And I was going to be a music major there. But then, you know, I stayed in economics, partly because I had this great background. And I was in my environmental economics class. And it was just so cool to go one week talking about, you know, preserving wildlife in Africa and saving elephants to then, you know, this is in Denton when the fracking ban started. So Denton County or City of Denton passed a ban on fracking. And after the fact, the state of Texas came in and said, no, you can't do that. We don't want that form of limited government. And then, you know, later on, I go on to graduate school at Texas Tech University. And I basically had front row seats to the wind boom. You know, every time I'd go visit family, I'd be able to see basically a new wind farm pop up on my way to or fro. So, you know, it's one of those cool little endogeneities where, well, am I interested in energy and environmental issues because of what was around me, or was I interested in it because I would go on to be energy and environmental economist? It's probably a little bit of both, but it's kind of been this lifetime of having this surrounding me and this cool policy space and interesting things happening. And then, you know, I move up to Oklahoma City, where I'm at University of Central Oklahoma, and, you know, it's one of the capitals of the fracking boom. And so energy has kind of been a part of my life ever, you know, since I went off to college.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And where in Texas did you grow up?
So I grew up in Austin, Texas.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Great city, Austin, Texas, of course.
Yeah.
All right. Well, man, we could talk about fracking and wind for the entire episode, I'm sure. But
oh, yeah.
We're going to talk about something else, which is your recent paper with Anne M. Burton. It's a working paper. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. And the paper is called Negative Externalities of Temporary Reductions in Cognition, Evidence from Particulate Matter Pollution and Fatal Car Crashes. So let's just start off by defining what is fine particulate matter. Most listeners probably know this, so we don't have to spend too long. But, you know, we also call this stuff PM2.5. So can you define PM2.5 and then help us or remind us what its main sources are?
Sure. So PM2.5, this is measured in microns, and the 2.5 refers to the literal size of this itty-bitty little particle. And so one way to kind of think about this is if you grabbed a, you know, strand of hair on your head, that probably has about 5 PM tins in there, so 10 microns wide. And then so each one of those little 10 microns, we're going to split up four times. So a single human hair has, 20, 30 PM2.5s within it. So it's a very incredibly small particle. And the issue here is that it is a result of basic combustion processes. So, you know, what's on the top of my mind is the Smokehouse Creek fire that's happening in West Texas. But we've seen these wildfires happening up in the Northwest and these plumes of smoke that are going across the country. So the West Texas fire right now, there were reports of Canadian folks seeing the smoke that was happening down there. So it travels a very great distance. So we think of wildfires, and that's one of the main sources of PM2.5. But the more impactful ones, the ones that hit us on a day-to-day basis, comes from coal plants, natural gas plants, basically any thermal unit, and then of course tailpipe emissions.
Right. Yeah, and I think if I'm not mistaken, I think it's mostly diesel more than gasoline that produces PM2.5. Is that right?
Right. Diesel has a higher concentration per cubic meter. So we'll talk about this later. But the way we measure this is in micrograms per cubic meter. And so diesel, it's very dense.
Yeah. Okay. Let's sort of do a quick literature review. So there have been a decent number of studies in the last few years that look at PM2.5 and try to estimate how it affects human health and also cognitive function. So can you give us some highlights in that literature?
Sure. Yeah, it does kind of feel like a little bit of a gold rush of folks studying this topic because it's just shown in so many different contexts and countries to be this really impactful and harmful source of pollution. So some of the very early work looked at animal studies and was looking at mammalian behavior and seeing that, you know, we have orangutans and rats and, you know, the traditional medical study participants, if you can call them that, were reacting differently when they were exposed to high pollution. And then this has kind of left the mammal route and come into the more human route where we can see how cognitive function among people is changing. So we've seen this with cognitive tasks. There's been various studies that, you know, will give you a slate of questions and ask you to do this. And we can measure your exposed pollution depending on what city you live in. Or in some cases, they're literally exposing to pollution in situ. They're putting that right there. And we're seeing that cognitive performance declines. One of the most famous examples is probably the case of umpires, which is one of those great examples of seeing something that's very verifiable. We can draw a box and see what's a strike and what's not a strike. And on days in cities where there's especially high PM2.5, we see that these umpires make more mistakes. And so this has gone into various different education outcomes. A lot of folks have looked in to see how does performance on standardized tests go after there's exposure. And then we're also seeing this with behavior and depression. So in more of the medical and epidemiological literature, we see that there are later in life outcomes that are very bad. So maybe the keystone paper here is Tatiana Darugina and Julian Reif and their co-authors, who see that there are bad effects on morbidity due to more early life exposure to PM2.5. And then Claudia Persico, she has fantastic, it's a very sad paper, but showing that there's a direct link between PM2.5 exposure and suicide. And then if we can kind of keep going this route of seeing how our brain process is affected and how might that spill out into regular economic behavior, we're also seeing that crime is affected. So there's a few great papers on this, but one, you know, is kind of using the proximity to a highway and whether the wind is blowing upstream or downstream of that highway. And, you know, it's this really neat natural experiment where you can see, okay, does crime increase on the upside here where the wind is blowing toward relative to the downstream side where the wind is blowing away from. And then this is even shown, you know, there's Twitter data that's fun to use, or at least it used to be easier to access and fun to use. And we could see that there's more aggressive and angry tweets happening in areas on days that are having this very high pollution exposure.
Yeah. Yeah. It sort of seems like the more we learn about PM2.5, the more troubling it sort of gets in all sorts of domains. And your paper focuses on the specific context of traffic accidents. So can you tell us a little bit about the data that you and your co-author use and the methods you use to try to figure out, like, how is PM affecting driving behavior in traffic accidents?
Sure. Yeah. So my co-author on this paper is Ann Burden, who is a really excellent health economist down at UT Dallas. And she has another paper looking at Uber's entrance into various markets and seeing how fatal accidents change. And what we did was we teamed up because I had some prior research on particulate matter pollution, and I knew she had looked into this outcome variable. And so what we wanted to do is kind of combine this idea of see, are there more fatal accidents on days that have high pollution? Because if the prior research suggests, which it very much does in a lot of contexts, a lot of countries, that you're both more aggressive and you make more errors in judgment. And one of the most costly places this can happen is while you're behind the wheel, something, you know, most Americans do every single day, either going to the store or going to work. And it's one of those shocks that affects everyone everywhere all at once. And so we wanted to look into this and see, okay, well, if the received literature here says that you are going to be more aggressive, you're going to make more mistakes, does that show up in these fatal outcomes? And what we'll eventually find is, yes, it very much does, is that by being exposed to higher pollution levels, we notice a statistically significant increase in the amount of fatal accidents in a county.
That's really interesting. Can you put some more meat on those bones? Like, how big is the effect and any other details you want to share?
Sure. So we see in our data, kind of across all the cities that are counties that we have data on fatal accidents and data on PM2.5 exposure, is that there's about, you know, population weighted, about a third of an accident a day. So you can kind of think about this as a fatal accident happening every 3 days. And so what we see is that by having more pollution exposure, there's a 1% increase in fatal accidents, which if there's 35,000 accidents per year, then what we're finding is that there's about 350 accidents that could be due to a single unit change in PM2.5. So for instance, it wouldn't be surprising to have a day where air quality is in this like 9 to 10 micrograms per cubic meter range. That would be considered basically healthy by current EPA standards, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a second. But a one unit increase would be, you know, you wouldn't notice that. You wouldn't see the air look different. You wouldn't feel that. But a one unit increase is what we're talking about by driving up these fatal accidents. So each unit increase is associated with a 1% increase in fatal accidents, which is quite large. If we kind of scale that up to a standard deviation change, that's about a 5% increase in fatal accidents. And so this is a very meaningful outcome, especially if you're behind the wheel. But if we could think about reduction or harm reduction on the other side, if when we move to a new particulate matter standard, that could really make a meaningful change in the amount of fatal accidents that happen per year.
Yeah. And as you said, we'll come back to that in a minute. Can you also give us a little more context on the wildfires, which is certainly something that all of us experienced in the summer of 2023, and that, of course, you know, folks in Texas and elsewhere are experiencing more recently? Like, what are some of the particulate matter level increases that communities might experience from like a big wildfire, and how might that map on to these results?
Yeah. Okay. So there's kind of two ways we could talk about that. What listeners are probably most used to is what's called an AQI, or an air quality index. If you have a weather app, this is probably the one that it shows you. If it gives you the, hey, maybe don't go for a jog today, the air quality is kind of bad. And so the normal range for AQI is from 0 to 500, 500 being, ooh, that's a bad day, you need to stay inside, 0 to 50 being air quality is good. Now, under the old 2012 standards, 0 to 50 being good kind of mapped on to PM2.5 being in the 0 to 12 micrograms per cubic meter range, which again, the majority of our data in this paper is in that range. There are several counties and several days that bump over that, but that's what we should consider good and normal. Now, as that scales up, so moderate is from 51 to 100 on the AQI, or air quality index scale. When we get into unhealthy for sensitive groups, that would be 100 to 150. And now what that means in micrograms per cubic meter, that's in the 35 to 55 range. So that would be a specifically bad day. That's the kind of day that's associated with some of these wildfires. And then when we get into AQIs of 151 and up, that is specifically unhealthy. That is when we have PM2.5 in the 55 up to 150 up to 250 micrograms per cubic meter. So really acute exposure to high levels of particulate matter.
That's great. And I, as you were answering that question, I was curious to see some of the real-time air quality in different parts of the country. And, you know, there's this great service called Purple Air where you can check real-time data. And where I live in Ann Arbor today, the AQI is about 88. So not great. And, you know, where you are in central Oklahoma, it's in the 60s to 70s today. And down in Austin, Texas, where you grew up, it's over 100.
Yeah, not great. I would recommend everyone in Austin, Texas today take the bus. At least make it someone else's fault if they get in a wreck.
Yeah, right. So for a little bit more context, can you help us understand how the scale of effects that you find from PM2.5 compares with the other types of things that can increase the risk of traffic fatalities? I'm thinking particularly about drunk driving, but I'm sure there are other causal factors here too, like, you know, weather and stuff like that.
Yeah, weather's certainly a matter. Drunk driving, like you mentioned, 2021, there were a little over 13,000 drunk driving fatalities, which is a staggering number. And, you know, one thing that we think is neat and interesting about this research is that this is kind of the shock. You know, economists are always trying to figure out, okay, what's the effect of this policy on this outcome variable? And so perhaps we have, you know, entering of Uber and Lyft that might, you know, meaningfully change the amount of drunk driving deaths, or we might increase the drinking age, or we might give curfews to teen drivers, and we would maybe expect that to change outcomes at the margin. But reducing particulate matter emissions is something that would affect both drunk drivers and non-drunk drivers. It might even, you know, if we are making bad decisions due to our exposure to particulate matter, then maybe that decision to have the extra drink doesn't occur because you're not making bad decisions in general. And so we view this as this kind of general equilibrium result where everyone is exposed to both higher or lower particulate matter emissions. And this can improve outcomes even for those people who are choosing to drive impaired, or maybe they're teenagers and they're not great at driving in the first place. And it can really meaningfully reduce these traffic fatalities.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wonder now if we can talk a little bit more about policy. So I'm curious if you can describe to us the current standards that EPA sets for PM2.5 under the Clean Air Act, how those might change, because I think there's been some rethinking of those standards in recent years, and also how that, again, compares to the results you find. So are the standards that EPA is enforcing now consistent with, you know, ensuring relatively low levels of PM exposure and reducing the types of traffic accidents that you're describing in this paper?
Yeah, it's a really important question. You know, it may turn out in hindsight that one of the most impactful things that the Biden administration does is lowering this PM2.5 standard. So right now, as of 2012, the PM2.5 standard to be considered good is about 12 micrograms per cubic meter, which prior to us having access to such good data, such good experimental methods, such good, you know, computing power, frankly, that seemed like a reasonable standard. In fact, it was an improvement. It used to be 15. It got bumped down to 12. But what a lot of the literature has seen is that we are seeing some of these negative impacts from high particulate matter exposure, just kind of on average over a year, is at a lower level than 12. So, you know, I did some prior research that showed that the threshold was at about 9 micrograms per cubic meter, and several others in the crime literature have seen that. So moving this new ambient standard from an average below 12 micrograms per cubic meter in a year down to 9, in our case, will very meaningfully change traffic fatalities. But then, you know, long-term exposure for people who will grow up in this world in which the standard is now down at 9 micrograms per cubic meter, they'll have lower lifetime exposure. And so this could reduce their risk of Alzheimer's. This could reduce their risk of dementia. This is the kind of thing that could change both their life in the immediate term and their life in the longer term.
Yeah. And just to clarify, I think you mentioned 2012 as the year when the standard went down to 12 units. This level of 9 units, is that something the EPA has currently proposed, or just kind of a number that's floating out there in the literature?
They proposed this kind of early February, February 7th, if my memory serves me right. And this was after, you know, a years-long discussion, the normal EPA process where they put out potential rulemaking, they think about this, they go, okay, what should the new standard be? And they announced early February that they will, in fact, be reducing the ambient air quality standard down to 9 micrograms per cubic meter.
That's interesting. And so do we have much of a sense of how that changing of the standard is likely to affect sources? So are we talking about, you know, shutting down more coal plants, switching more diesel to electric, or what are some of the sectors that are likely to be most affected?
Yeah, I think of the coal-powered sector as one of the most and first things that will be affected by this. Where we'll see this most likely have bite is in permitting of new coal units. So suppose someone wanted to introduce a new coal-fired plant in an area, which that's not really happening here. Yeah. But they would face more strict permitting standards, especially in areas. So this will, you know, it will take a transition period. There are currently several counties that would be outside of attainment status. So if you are currently in that 12 region, because that was the old standard, moving down to 9 is going to take some changes. And so especially in those areas that are on, kind of on the bubble of attainment and non-attainment, it would be very unlikely that they, you know, the government, when considering whether or not to permit a new power plant, they have to take that into consideration. And now, you know, to vehicle exhaust, you know, specifically, EVs will help, absolutely. There's no tailpipe emissions on an EV. However, where they get the electricity source, of course, matters. And then add to the fact, though, that EVs tend to be heavier, and so their tires wear out a little bit differently. And so those, the tire dust can turn into its own little particulate matter. So I don't want to make it feel like, oh, that will be a easy solution. We'll get there quickly. You know, there's no free lunch, as the economists like to say.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, sort of worth thinking about environmental justice implications here, too, because this is a sort of ambient standard. It would, you know, account for the cumulative burdens that communities experience in places like the Gulf Coast or, you know, other areas where there's lots of industrial facilities. Do you sort of see it as an EJ issue, or is the pollution so dispersed that it has kind of broader effects than just on EJ communities?
Certainly an environmental justice issue here. You know, the housing around our most polluting areas tends to be cheaper. There's a revealed preference that people do not want to live next to a power plant. Well, if there's housing that is cheaper, that tends to be lower income folks who are living around that area. And so they are specifically burdened by a lot of the environmental pollution we've seen, you know, thus far in our country's history. But, you know, it's kind of one of those hopeful results that has been shown in this literature, is that the Clean Air Act and its amendments have really reduced the burden on specifically, you know, lower socioeconomic folks who happen to be living in these areas that have high industrial activity.
Yeah. So one more question, and this is, I don't know how far outside of your expertise this one is, but I'm just really curious about it, which is, like, how much do we know about what's actually happening inside of our bodies that leads to these negative cognitive impacts? Like, how does the particulate matter get into our bodies? Do different kinds of particulate matter affect us in different ways, right? If it's tire dust versus, you know, coal ash versus something else, does that have different effects? Like, what do we know about the physiology here?
Yeah, so I'll try and do my best to put my biologist hat on here. But so part of your question there was asking about the speciation of the particulate matter. So sure, it's a tiny itty bitty particle, but what is it actually made up of? I think that's kind of our research frontier here, is it made up of a heavy metal that's a result of the combustion process at a coal plant, or is it a little piece of rubber from a tire? I think that is something that we're still looking at and learning about. But as far as how it kind of gets into your body and then kind of bioaccumulates within your body. So you breathe it in, and these particles are so tiny that they're able to exit the lungs through the blood. And when it's in the blood, that, you know, it's taking up valuable real estate there. And so this leads to oxidative stress in your brain. So think, you know, if your brain is suddenly getting less oxygen than it otherwise would, well, you're going to make a few more mistakes. You might tend toward a little bit more aggression. And so that's where we see some of these immediate term effects happening, is because the particulate matter is coming in, it's messing with your blood oxygen levels. But the more long-term issues seem to be with this kind of crossing the blood-brain barrier and these tiny particles getting lodged into folds of the brain and various other parts of your body. And that's why we're seeing this effect. You know, we see increased Alzheimer's is one of the big results here, is that, you know, cognitive impairment in your older age really starts to go down, in part just because the particulate entered the body, traveled through the bloodstream, and got stuck.
Yeah, and once it's stuck, does it sort of disintegrate? Does it stay there? Do we know much about that?
If we do know about it, that's something I don't know about.
Yeah, interesting. So a podcast for another day.
Yeah.
Well, Travis, this has been really interesting. You know, there are so many interesting studies on PM2.5 that we've talked about today, and your paper definitely adds to the literature on such an important topic. I'd love to ask you now about what you're reading or what you're watching or what you're listening to, something that's at the top of your literal or your metaphorical reading stack that you think is great and that you'd recommend to our listeners.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do a little bit of a left turn from what folks often suggest here. This is, I should say, one of my normal favorite parts of the podcast. I've gotten so many great book recommendations over the years. But what is literally on the top of my stack right now is a book called Prairie Up, An Introduction to Natural Garden Design by Benjamin Vogt. That's spelled V-O-G-T. And so I think my hope here is to maybe inspire people who are thinking about picking up a book is maybe, well, pick up this book, but then also get out in your yard and go plant some native plants. This is specifically, you know, this is a passion project of mine. This is what I like to do in my free time. But I do think there's this kind of barrier to entry. And, you know, how do you get started with natural gardening? And this is the perfect book to help you get there. How do you use native plants? What are the different types you can do? And, you know, how to make it also look beautiful. And so I think, A, go pick up this book, but then B, maybe go pick up a shovel and carve out a big section of your lawn and turn it into something that's very useful for the wildlife around you.
That's really cool. Yeah, I'm just looking this up. It looks like a really fascinating book. And actually, my wife and I and our five-year-old were thinking about what we want to plant this year as spring is coming around. So it's a timely and an excellent recommendation.
Awesome. And if I can add a couple more recommendations here, just because I've done this a few times. So you're going to go out, you're going to mark out the area you want to add. Whatever that is, you should probably double its size, because this is a job you really only want to do once and digging out any kind of Bermuda that might be there. And then, you know, I think this is the kind of thing that a lot of researchers and that type of person listens to this podcast. So this is the kind of thing that you can scratch that itch. Go find some good native plants by your ecoregion. And there's a ton of sources online to buy these. I'm thinking Missouri Wildflowers is a good one, Prairie Moon Nursery, Prairie Nursery, Isle Nursery. So you can get these online, or probably, hopefully, locally to you. And, you know, pick yourself five plants and just repeat these in this bed. It doesn't have to be a very complex thing. Pick two or three grasses that are native to your region. Pick an aster that's native to your region. Pick a goldenrod or a sunflower, a helianthus that's native to your region. And then maybe do something for a special butterfly, you know. Plant something for the swallowtails, plant something for the monarchs. And, you know, you're thinking about five or six plants at all, and then just repeat them in your area.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Awesome. Well, Travis Roach, one more time from the University of Central Oklahoma, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your research on PM2.5, vehicle crashes, your suggestions on gardening tips. It's been a really fun conversation.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Resources Radio, a podcast from Resources for the Future, or RFF. If you have a minute, we'd really appreciate you leaving us a rating or a comment on your podcast platform of choice. Also, feel free to send us your suggestions for future episodes. This podcast is made possible with the generous financial support of our listeners. You can help us continue producing these kinds of discussions on the topics that you care about by making a donation to Resources for the Future online at rff.org/donate. RFF is an independent, nonprofit research institution in Washington, D.C. Our mission is to improve environmental, energy, and natural resource decisions through impartial economic research and policy engagement. The views expressed on this podcast are solely those of the podcast guests and may differ from those of RFF experts, its officers, or its directors. RFF does not take positions on specific legislative proposals. Resources Radio is produced by Elizabeth Wasson, with music by me, Daniel Raby. Join us next week for another episode.